drove up, my wife drove, and it took us 9.5 hours to drive up. Cars going off the side of the road, and somebody made, when we got here, somebody made the comment, I wonder if this weather will, you know, kill the conference. And somebody else says, not with alcoholics. Now, it might kill a Shriners convention. But it was true. Everybody got here. This room was full. And average people wouldn't have gone out and gotten the mail. And I know what my job is here. Since I was here 6 years ago, I think I'll tell Buck Melton's story. He's got a hell of a story. I know what my purpose is, and I do this probably too much, but I never fail to be nervous about it. I never fail to start taking myself seriously and not my mission seriously. And I think probably my task is a serious one, but myself, I shouldn't take seriously. Mark's right. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous over half my life. And I can't think of a better place to spend one's half life or whatever than in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get smart or develop character or find willpower or anything that I didn't know I had, and the reason I got in early. I hit the ground running. My 14 years of active alcoholism was as sick drinking, as pathologic as anybody's story I've ever heard. So I immediately connected with alcohol in that way that alcoholics connect with alcohol that gets us in trouble. And I'll talk, I hope, a little bit about that and talk some about what's happened to me in the last 33 plus years. One of the things that keeps going through my mind lately is just the fundamental root of basic things about our condition. And I've been talking a lot about it. So if you've heard me recently, forgive me. I'm just talking a lot about this. That we, this theme of Dr. Silkworth in the book, what Alcoholics Anonymous thesis, what Alcoholics Anonymous is saying to us, that we're bodily and mentally different. We're not just careless or weak-willed or you know, bad people or whatever. There's something different about us. And the experts have said that, and we laugh sometimes at the experts. We make sport of the experts. But the experts are sober, you know, they're out there observing us, and they know some things. And one of the things the experts seem to agree on, that about 10%, about 1 in 10 people who experiment with the drug alcohol become what we know by definition as an alcoholic. Just 1 in 10 get from this particular thing that special thing that causes trouble. And I believe it's what it does for us that gets us in trouble with it. It's what it does to us that hopefully brings us here. The experts say that about everybody will at some point experiment with alcohol, and many people continue to drink it, but just 1 in 10 has the trouble that we define as alcoholism. Or the way I like to put it, 9 in 10 waste every drop they drink. And we know them, yeah. They're everywhere, you know. They outnumber us, you know, we marry them. Go to work for them. You know, the 9 in 10, there are a lot of bosses in the 9 in 10. A lot of next-door neighbors in the 9 in 10. So the observation of them by us when we're active alcoholics is we wonder about those folks, don't we? And wonder what the difference is. And we tell ourselves those lies that we tell ourselves, that if I could just have a wife like his, you know, or if I just had his job, or if I just had the breaks that he has, I could drink or not drink like he does. Dr. Silkworth is one of those experts. He was one of these non-alcoholic experts who has a chapter in our book, who offers a contribution to our book. And it's a beautiful chapter. And his observation of us was not a scientific study. That's not what he did. He just observed thousands of us going through his hospital, town's hospital. And he said, there's something different about these people. These folks are bodily and mentally different. And it mystified him, but he noticed that there was some effect, reaction that the alcohol had on us that was different physically. And he didn't know what to call it, but he said, it's like an allergy. It's like when these folks, they drink it because they like it. They like the effects produced by alcohol. That's why they drink it, but it affects them like an allergy. It makes them sick. And something happens with these people that he called a phenomenon of craving. These guys, he says, they take a drink and an agitation, a discomfort, a craving happens to them, doesn't happen to the ordinary drinker, and they can't stop. Now these symptoms that are outlined in the big book and are outlined by some of the experts outside of the writings of the big book happened to me very early, as I said. I came up in an alcoholic home. I came up in a home with a dual problem. We had alcoholism and Southern Baptism right there in the same house. And I usually say, you don't get over either one of those. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a Southern Baptist, always a Southern. Fight it if you will. I just retired from a job. My boss was an Episcopal priest, gone through Episcopal seminary. And I used to tell him, he was raised a Southern Baptist. I said, you can be an Episcopal priest, but if somebody would wake you up in the middle of the night, you'd talk Southern Baptist. It's in your... And I came up with that, the negative image of beverage alcohol. It was preached against, of course, in my rearing. And I came up witnessing what active alcoholism could do to a man, my father, and to a family. The insecurities, the embarrassment, all the things. My father was a gentle drunk. He was not a mean drunk. He was not particularly unpredictable while drinking. He would just sort of fall down in the wrong places and embarrass us. But he was never a cruel, profane, or any... like I later came to be. But the insecurity, the uncertainty, the feeling of difference that the alcoholic family feels from the other so-called normal folks was always present. And I was sure I would never drink. And then along came that thing we call peer pressure. I was doing that earlier. You know, I learned to smoke Lucky Strikes that way. I learned to inhale. Now, the new younger people like Mark are not impressed with this because they put stuff in their lungs that we've never heard of. But back then, if you could inhale a Lucky Strike without your knees buckling and you'd hang around in front of Manzo Henry drugstore like I did, I became a cat. Had my hair all combed and full of that grease. They made it in draped pants, and I went through my cat period. I was smoking Lucky Strikes, and I remember, since it's a new crowd, I'll talk about this too. Some of the people have heard this ad nauseum, but I had a little hair problem because I had, and still do, have real fine hair, and it wouldn't do right, and I put a half a bottle of Wild Root cream oil on it or something. It just would stay, and so I had an advisor that told me about pomade. And pomade was like wax, and like shoe polish wax, and my hair problem was over. I could comb it like this big ducktail, and they'll brag about it. You know, the Final Net people, they ran a commercial several years ago where they have a lady that has a hectic day. At the end of the day, she's pooped, but her hair's all in place. She said, and the Final Net people think this is the greatest thing in the world. Pomade would hold your hair for 3 months. You know, it grew out. You know, I'd say if a train hit you and they could find your head, your hair would be a perfect place. But anyway, that has nothing to do with anything except this was a crowd, this was a group, this was the milieu that I found alcohol. Now, I resisted. I had guilt and fear associated with alcohol. But I begin to drink out of peer pressure. I begin to drink the same reason I begin to smoke. I begin to drink the same reason I put pomade in my hair. I begin to drink so I would be included in this group. So I hadn't been getting along too well with the good crowd. You know that part of the book that Bill writes, we sought lower companionship? I was doing that in the third grade. I was having trouble pleasing the establishment way back. And so I was seeking people like me for a long time, and I found these guys. And they drank. So to be like them, I drank. And I had a little social drinking period there that you might be interested in. As best I could figure, in looking back and taking my inventory, I was a social drinker for about 6 weeks. Ever how long it took me, after I'd had a half a can of this or a swallow of that, ever how long it took me to ingest enough to feel it. And I can remember the circumstance, I can remember who I was with, I can remember where I was. We were at the Green Hill Cemetery in Greensboro, where we would go to do a lot of things where we needed privacy and not to be bothered. And I can remember we were drinking a cheap wine. And that night, I knew for the first time intoxication. Then that magic that happened to me that doesn't seem to happen to 9 in 10 occurred. Now, I cannot describe that to people who are non-alcoholics, that feeling. It doesn't need probably description. I'll just say that it filled a hole that I didn't even know existed, that I didn't know I had. It made me enough. It put a filter between me and the world that I had needed for a long time. It made me comfortable in a world that for me was mostly uncomfortable. And so I submit if you find something that'll do that for you, you'll continue to do it. And even though I had guilt and even though I had fear associated with the use of beverage alcohol, right then, that night, from that moment on, a drinking pattern was set. Now, when we talk about these symptoms, you know what the other things experts say? Here's another little tidbit for you if you're new. All the old timers know this. This blackout thing, these little spells of amnesia you've been having, you know, that doesn't happen to the 9 in 10. It's a real interesting thing. If you're having memory lapses, join up. Now that's the experts say that doesn't happen to the 90%. You can experiment with them if you want to. I mean, non-alcoholics can get drunk. We're not the only ones that can become intoxicated. Non-alcoholics can do it too. Nothing more disgusting than a non-alcoholic who's drunk. Nothing more unsafe on the road than some New Year's Eve non-alcoholic out there blowing a .07, hitting both curbs and God knows what. Most of us in this room have blown a 26. Driven straight as an arrow. We've learned this. To reduce those lines, might be going 18 miles an hour. But you can get them just needle walking comatose drunk and they'll remember everything. I didn't. I was fine. I had these, as a friend of mine said, I had these blackouts when they first came out. I had them young. You get those reports of something that happened in some place I had been, something I had done that I had forgotten. They got me mixed up with somebody else, and then they've got evidence and witnesses that it did happen, and I said, I forgot that. You know, the phenomenon of craving, I knew about that when I was 18, 19 years old. I was down at Campbell College at Bowie's Creek, North Carolina, and I can remember one night there was a big something going on campus. I don't know what the occasion was, but people were partying and having a good time. And me and my crowd, as usual, were broke. And so we couldn't afford anything to drink. And I wanted something to drink real bad. I wanted to join in the revelry. And somehow, some way, somebody that night produced a pint of bourbon whiskey. and there were five or six of us sitting around at the time, and he produced it and said, "I've got a pint, let's pass it around and have a drink." I'm 18 or 19 years old, I refuse that drink. The alcoholics know why. I knew that I was going to be more agitated, more uncomfortable. I would feel worse after a drink than I did with no drinks, and I wanted to drink awfully bad. I knew about the phenomenon of craving before I knew there was such a term. My alcoholism began quickly. What it started doing to me, along with what it was doing for me, began to happen pretty fast. I began to lose control of the amount I was drinking. That's alcoholism. Non-alcoholics don't lose control. If they do, they just do it once, you know. You know, you run into them. I did that one time. Drunk and sick and call my mother a bad name. I've never done it since. What we do it over and over until we get it right. And blame my mother. Lose control more and more because of this physical difference in me than my fellows. And whatever would start with me, I couldn't finish. I couldn't drink enough. And so although alcohol was doing a lot for me, it began to do these things to me, and I began to recognize there's a price on this. And I began to do the things we do. I tried to do it different. Well, I'll just drink here, or I'll just drink beer, or whatever. I began to lose control of my behavior. That's alcoholism. I could not predict how I was going to behave. I could not predict how I would react to the drug this time. I wanted to be funny and happy in the life of the party, and I began to be antisocial. And I did things that embarrassed others and hurt others and embarrassed me and hurt me, and I did things that caused relationships to dissolve. Now, along in here, I went to, as I said, I got out of high, went to very little bit of college, and I had to finish college in my 50s because, you know, alcoholism took it away from me then. I didn't do very well in my first try. But I did what about every alcoholic does. I got married. Now, we'll do that. You know, probably we could wipe this disease off the face of the earth if the alcoholic would go off in the woods and progress by himself. We don't do that. We'll marry somebody. Have youngins. Have a little family disease. And that's what I did. I married the gal that you'll hear from tomorrow. We met in high school. And when I drank up college and I was in some trouble here, I joined the Army. Back then, everybody had to do a service obligation. I needed to leave town. There was some trouble there. And I joined the Army. Became a neuropsychiatric technician. Great little job for an alcoholic. I was sort of in the self from my very earliest memory, and I was sort of a hypochondriac anyway. And I'd go, you know, as a kid, I'd go see a movie and somebody would die of malaria or something. I'd start getting symptoms. Well, when I was being trained for psychiatric disorders, I had about everyone that taught me about it. You know, I'd be a film on schizophrenia or something. I said, "My God, I have that." And that's I can identify with that. And it's kind of a scary feeling. To be working in a psychiatric hospital, knowing that you got all that stuff. Yeah. So I would act as sane as I possibly could. Wouldn't do for them to know. And let me tell you, that I'm toying with tonight and talking a lot about, that difference between us and them, it mystifies the experts, and I guess billions of dollars have been spent on examining us and studying us. And there's no telling how many rats they've killed, giving them convulsions and all that kind of stuff. And it just amazing. And to my knowledge, not a dime has been spent studying those non-alcoholics, and they way outnumber us. And most of you in this room know that they mystify us more than we mystify them. And so what I've done is taken that upon myself, and I hadn't had any government grants or whatever, so what I've done, since I am married, and you'll hear tomorrow, to one of the worst cases of non-alcoholism you've ever seen in your life, I figure this is a perfect study. Because over the years that we've known each other, she's consumed some alcohol. Pitiful, you know how they'll do. And there's been times, especially younger, she's ingested enough to feel it. Years ago. Get enough in her to get a buzz. You know what she does? She stops. Let me repeat that for the new person. She gets the pilot lit and stops. That demands research. Somebody needed to look into that a long time ago. So I've asked her, why do you do that? And she said, because when I begin to feel it, I feel as if I'm losing control. And I don't like that feeling, so I stop. Ain't that interesting? When I would leave that award afraid I was going to fly apart and then somebody would zip me open and find out I'm just as crazy as the people I was supposed to be keeping, and I would go up to the club and begin to drink, the only semblance of control I had any time during that day was when that stuff started to take effect. Same drug, same chemical that makes her feel that she's losing control, that gets her out of control, was the only thing that ever gave me any remote feeling of control. And that's all the difference I need. I don't need to do, they don't need to kill another rat. They don't need to do any, publish any more studies. That's all I need. There's something different from her to me. And they don't need to do any more studies about it. Now, at the time, I'm coming away having the children and everything, and the alcoholism is getting bad, and the drinking is getting bad, and my life is unmanageable. And people that know us and people that know me know that there's something wrong with my drinking, and I begin, as I said earlier, to lose friends, to lose acquaintances, to lose people that would invite us over or accept our invitation over. That was long gone. And I begin to go where the lower companions are. And I begin to hang around at those places. And all we do with lower companionship, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. These are the people and these were the places that made my behavior and my drinking at least seem somewhat normal, somewhat acceptable. And I drink and I begin to, and I'm going to hurry up through this, I begin to lose the jobs. And I begin to take lower and lower jobs in station. Became a salesman, you know, straight commission. I'm gonna earn what, you know, I'm worth. That'll starve you to death if you're an alcoholic. And I was working for more and more crooked. I've gotten to the bait and switch business. It's just a terrible thing. And the drinking got to that place where I discovered the morning drink, as we like to say, and I begin to drink in the mornings. And I begin to drink around the clock, and I begin to go to bed with drinking. I would start out doing different. I'd start out like I was going to have a night on the town, but I would end up in that bed. I would end up drinking around the clock. I'd end up not bathing. I'd end up not changing that underwear that I drank around the clock in. I was a fun drunk. Charming. You know how romance leaves the house. You know, if you don't bathe or eat for a week or 10 days, you know, it's your sex life suffers. Romance suffers. So it was no secret, really, what was happening with me in our house. People had, as I said, withdrawn, and It was the middle of summer of 1966. I'm 28 years old. I'm working for this crooked company, and I was up in St. Louis working for them. I'd been up there for 2 weeks. I was supposed to be up there for 2 weeks, but I was drunk for 2 weeks. And I flew back, and then I'm tapering off. I'd learned to taper off, sort of self-detox. You know, I would learn to, my daddy used to do that, and I found out just to quit drinking abruptly was pretty bad, so I would try to dose myself down. And I had a lot of trouble with it, getting the dosage exactly right. I didn't have any attending medical people. I was trying to do it myself. And then Kay was, she would always confuse it with drinking, because it does look alike, you know, if you're tapering. You have to explain that over and over. You know, I quit drinking yesterday. Today I'm tapering off. Well, I would get drunk tapering off and just have to start up, and I'd just be in that situation. And I came home that way. And I get to my drinking uniform, the underwear, and she picked me up at the airport, and I'm tapering off in the lounge, and she brings me home, and I get down to my underwear, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is not the first thing out of the chute. You know, alcoholics don't call AA first, do we? We do everything else. We go from everything from exercise programs to diets to whatever. I'd been to a psychiatrist while I was in the Army. I had gone to counseling with the minister, even marriage counseling with the minister. I had bought a book on yoga. It has several testimonials on the cover, including how a young man overcame his battle with the bottle, and I bought it, and I probably would have worked, but I never could stand on my head and all that stuff because I was drunk. But this day, this hot July day, I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I reached in Greensboro there. I reached, by the way, Brown Summit is a suburb of Greensboro, so I'm really from Greensboro. I'm just technically, I'm in another post office just outside the city. Greensboro at that time answered through an answering service. It was just hired by various people who hired the answering service, and through that a man by the name of Bill Norman, whom some of you know, I know Red knows him, called me back, and we chatted. And he was about as narrow-minded about tapering off as Kay. Yeah. You're drinking, aren't you? Well, not really. I'm tapering off, but he didn't want to come and rush to my aid while I was tapering off, but I had his name and number, and so when she got home, she was out of the house at the time. I wasn't going to call her in front of her. When she came back in, I had that just like the cross and the vampire, you know, before you open your mouth, hush. I held up his name and number. I turned in myself into the ANA, and this. He and I agree I'm not ready yet, but when I am, I'm going to call him back. Let me suffice it to say I didn't call him back. I didn't call him back that next week that I had promised, or the week after, or the month after, and several months went by. I don't know how much time. But at some point after several months, when it was apparent that I was not going to call again Bill, she did. Now, she'd been doing things too, and I won't go into those things, but she had let the secret out a long time ago, and she had sought help other places with other people, other resources, but this time she tells me, and she'll tell you probably about this a little bit tomorrow, she called someone who not only understood, but who offered a solution. And he listened sympathetically. And then he said, hold the phone, and he put Lib on the phone. And Lib told Kay about that one night. Now, as I'll say 90% of the time I'm up at a podium like this, that Al-Anon probably won't cure you drinking if your spouse or loved one gets in there. But it'll break your rhythm, I'll guarantee you that. Buck, and some of you remember Ronnie Cates. Ronnie Cates had a lot of bad luck in getting sober, but he died with some sobriety a few years ago, and I was honored to help carry the box. And Ronnie was a good man, and Ronnie put it better than anybody that I've ever heard. He said when all else failed, he could play dead in the living room floor. And the Reedy, his wife, would come over and at least shake him and find out if he was alive. Sometimes it even upset the kids. Ruby joined Al Anon, she could vacuum around him. What happens is my disease begin to lose its power inch by inch, little by little over her. That's all. Didn't fix my alcoholism. It did that thing that it does. It made my disease less controlling of her. And so I credit Al-Anon as much as anything with at least my getting to the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous, because she began to be free of alcoholism just a little bit at a time. On Wednesday night, she would go to the, you know what they called it? The AA, Central AA Women's Auxiliary. That's what they called it. That's a long time ago. They were doing Al-Anon. And she began to get better in some sort of health, some sort of wellness, some sort of spiritual, some sort of newness came into our house that I didn't even recognize. It was June the 2nd of 1967, and I am out of schemes and plans. My bag of tricks is empty. This is a good place for an alcoholic to be. I don't have any more dodges. I don't have any more delay tactics. I don't have any more lies that you're going to believe, that she's going to believe, that boss is going to believe, that even I can believe. I don't have any more fresh starts in me. I don't know if you know about fresh starts, but I was the best fresh starter in the world. And I'd grab her and we'd look off in that horizon and I would promise her that this will never happen again and I'm going to do this and I'm not going to do that. And life's going to be better and we're going to be happy. And I know you're right about my drinking. What's wrong in this house is my drinking and I'm not going to do any drinking anymore. And she would believe it time after time after time, and the reason she would believe it is because I believed it. And my presentation, my case, was always convincing. And this time I just didn't have that. There wasn't any more of that. When I called in the middle of summer that previous year, my bag of tricks was almost empty. I was almost out of options, but this time I just didn't have anything else. And she looked at me. I was coming off the 200th, the 300th drunk. And when I drank, damage was done. When I drank, I was sick. When I was drunk, at the end of these drunks, I hid out. I don't know if you know that. I don't know anything more terrifying than me coming off drunk and the phone ringing. Who in the world is that on the other end of the phone? Nothing more terrifying except the front door bell ringing. That'd get me under the rug. And on June the 2nd, 1967, which through this moment, thank God, is my sobriety date, we called Bill back. I hadn't talked with him in 10 months, 10 and a half months. And as soon as he knew who it was on the other end of the phone, she dialed the phone for me, by the way. That's back when you had the holes in there. You know, you had to... No, she knew. She'd been on Al-Anon, knew I should be doing it myself, but she knew I couldn't get my finger in there 7 times, and so she ran around for me. But she handed me the phone, and he said, "Are you about ready to throw in the towel now?" And I said, "I sure am," because I sure was. And he said, "I'll come see you in the morning." This is a fair late hour on a Friday night. He said, "I'll come see you tomorrow morning." And he came. And he came into that little house I was about to lose. My payments were $100 a month on that little house, and I couldn't pay him, and Cameron Brown Mortgage was going to take it and sell it on the courthouse steps. And the car in the driveway was wrecked just enough that the bank wouldn't take it. You ever had one like that? It'll still run, but the bank will give you another extension when they take a look at that side you just took a telephone pole off with. And he did that perfect 12-step call. He was generous with his time, and he was generous with his attention to me and apparent caring about me. And I listened to him, and he listened to me, and at some point he asked me to make a promise, a commitment. Just two things. will you not drink for the rest of this day, and will you go with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight? And I'm out of schemes and plans. I don't have another delay tactic. I don't have another lie. I don't have anything to put her off or him off with. And I said, I will. I had a little pride. I didn't want him pulling the AA van up at the house. When he offered to pick me up, I said, no, I'll meet you there. And we did. And I had that feeling that we feel when we go into an AA. I mean, it was an open speaker meeting back then in Greensboro. Like a lot of places, most meetings were speaker meetings. They had a couple of discussion meetings, but most of them were speaker meetings. And I went in that speaker meeting with about 20 people in there in a very plush room. The ladies study at the Starmount Presbyterian Church there in Greensboro. It was a Starmount group. And I walked in there thinking everybody was looking at me. You know how we are. You know? Everybody's wondering why I'm here. If you're thinking, if you're new and you're thinking that, let me let you in on a little secret. If you're in a group of alcoholics, I don't care if it's AA or the Elks Club, they ain't paying any attention to anybody but themselves. I don't care if it's been sober 100 years. You can walk in with two heads in an AA meeting. Everybody's checking themselves out. There's nobody. But I didn't know that. I thought I was the center of the universe. And I'm going to hurry up and try to sit down in the next couple of minutes. Get sober and stay sober a few minutes and tell you how it is. Two distinct miracles happened to me that night. Now, a ton of miracles had happened. The very fact I was breathing in and out and could get into that room that night, the very fact I was sitting there was a miracle. But let me tell you two that are just as clear as a bell to me in retrospect. After they did that reading that meant nothing to me, that reading you heard tonight that means so much to me and us now meant nothing, of course, when I was new. It was like Greek to me. Somebody climbed up to the podium and did what I'm doing tonight. He told a story that I've heard 1,000, 2,000 times. I don't know. I've been to a bunch of speaker meetings. No telling how many times I've heard somebody climb up to a podium like this and tell their story. And it's wonderful every time. Now, tomorrow night, I may go to, or when I get back home Monday night, I may go to a meeting and the guy will get up there and say, I never made it, I'm drunk right now. But thus far, it's had that happy ending. Miracle number one, I understood what he was saying. Took him 50 minutes, like we do, to tell the story. But I understood that he was saying to us, these 18 or 20 people sitting out in front of him today, that he had drunk alcohol hopelessly, just like me. And that he'd come here and he hadn't been drinking and life was good, and I understood that. And I didn't have much of an attention span. I'd been sober one day. By any right, I couldn't have sat and listened to anybody about anything for 2 minutes, much less that whole hour. And I sat there and not only listened to him, but understood him. Miracle number two, the hook, the thing that probably saved my life was I believed him. And I hadn't believed anybody or anything in so long. I didn't even believe in God. At least that's what I told myself. Now, I know I just retired from a job where I worked with people newly getting sober, new in the program. And I kid them a lot. I used to kid them a lot when I was working before I retired last year. Because we'd have to work AA into their schedule. You know, I got soccer this night and they're doing this kind of thing. When I came into AA, my nights were free. I had been kicked out of the Bamboo Lounge and the Varsity Grill for life. Now, the Bamboo Lounge, let me tell you about the Bamboo Lounge. You probably, every town's got one. I probably don't need to describe it. The Bamboo Lounge is where you go when you cannot go anyplace else. And I couldn't go back there. So my nights were free. So when they said you go to all these meetings, I couldn't say, well, I've got this and I got that. I didn't have to check my social calendar. I knew I was available on those nights. And my days were free, too. I'd been fired for the fourth time from the same job. And I went there to the, and I would stay. Bill at the time told Kay, drop him off at the club. This is what Lib did with me when I first got sober and leave him there. she was working, I wasn't, and pick him up that evening, and that night he'll go to a meeting, and that's what I did. I'd go up there in that safe club and spend all day, and drunks would come in and out and talk to me and share with me. And the things of Alcoholics Anonymous begin to happen to me, like it does. The miracle of, you know how it is, I was an agnostic, you know, and I told myself I was an agnostic. I tell you you're an agnostic. This would even get me attention at the Varsity Grill or some of these places, but not in AA. I remember Bill said, I want you to go to all these meetings, but I don't want you to go to the Sunday night discussion meeting. There was the only meeting in town. There was only one meeting at that time. There's probably a dozen on Sunday nights now, but the only one meeting in Greensboro at that time is the Sunday night. Don't go there. There's a couple of screwballs up there that will confuse you. So don't go. Well, of course, I couldn't wait to Sunday night. And I sneaked off to the Sunday night discussion meeting. It was a step discussion meeting. It wasn't real hard to tell who the screwballs were. In fact, we just recently had a conversation about them and whatever happened to them. And I remember one had died very tragically, shot his wife and killed himself. And another one, we don't know what happened to him. We just assume he's probably dead by now. But it wasn't real hard. But I was an agnostic and had some new ideas. And I was younger. I was 29, younger than most people did at that time. So I sort of shifted it from a 2-screwball meeting to a 3-screwball meeting. And while I was running my mouth and while I was not listening to other people, not everybody in that meeting or in that group was a screwball, and they cared enough about me to get me aside and say, in this fellowship, in this deal that you're doing now, we don't really have the luxury of not believing in God. And I was referred to chapter 4, and if you hadn't read that lately, it's a good one to peek at. And I read the chapter, We Agnostics, time after time after time. I know why I did it now, because I wanted to believe. I want to be just as dumb as those people that believe, you know. And I would read that chapter. And let me refer you to just the first paragraph if you hadn't read it lately. If you got a short attention span like I did, and you have a tough time wading through 44 questions and this kind of thing, if you're trying to kind of qualify yourself, read paragraph 1 in chapter 4. And if you don't have the attention span to wade through the whole paragraph, just read the last final 2 sentences in the first paragraph. Because it says, and I would see this, it would be like a neon blinking light every time I'd see it. It'd say, if when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, and this is where Bill gets that soft sell, you're probably alcoholic, he says. Like if you got web feet and you find yourself quacking, you might be a duck. You might want to check into that. If when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely. Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, by golly, that described me. You're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, it says, you're suffering from a condition that only a spiritual experience can conquer. Not in the top 5th percentile, not in most cases, it's a strong recommendation, but only. And I was told that some of you got up in the morning and prayed, whether you believed it or not in the beginning, just let me have this day without a drink. And if that worked at night by coincidence or otherwise, said thank you. And I begin to do that. And that's how I came to believe. Now the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does are real simple. And minds like mine, people like me, confuse it, complicate it. It's real simple. One of the things that we don't recognize right in the beginning, and I know I didn't, is that people ain't working on their drinking problem here. I've been working on my drinking problem a lot. I had addressed it from all kinds of ways, read about it, did all kinds of things to work on my drinking problem, and it dawned on me that y'all weren't working on a drinking problem. You're working on a solution. And I got into the solution, and some of the solution was very basic. Some of it in the beginning was just attend the meetings, have your butt in a chair, get in the car. Some of it had to do with emptying the ashtrays, make the coffee. Do those basic things. And in that time, when we say the prayer, and it's that time when we do the inventory. And you know how we are. If you're like me, I want to know, why did I do that inventory? And they said, do it and you'll know why. And you put those grudges down. I know I sponsored a guy. In fact, he's still a dear friend. And he was having trouble getting started on his grudge list. I said, I tell you what, get the Greensboro phone directory. Mark out anybody you don't know. You hate the rest of them. That's your grudge list. And realizing that these people that were in my head had power over me. That's what managed my life. And I begin to know those manifestations of self. Self-centeredness, selfishness, that we think is the root of our problem. That's what was eating me up from the inside. And I didn't know what I was doing through this steps 4 through 9, and we do this vigorous house cleaning. I didn't know what I was doing, but I know now. I'm taking this garbage, this past that was killing me, eating me up from the inside, and I'm putting it in God's hands, and I'm making it my greatest asset. I'm making the worst things about me the most powerful tool that I have, not only to prevent me from repeating the past, but to help someone else. I got with the winners. And let me tell you, the winners ain't hard to spot. No old-timer has to get you over the side and say, they winners and they losers. We know. You've been around 2 or 3 weeks. You know who's got what you want and who doesn't. Stick with the winners. The winners stuck with me, and they started taking me to things like this. And I ended up with an old sponsor. Was a 12-stepping sponsor. We called on drunks under any circumstances, anywhere. And we didn't look for sincere, motivated ones like mental health counselors do. Yeah. How about right on our chart? Not motivated. If you're looking for a motivated, sincere, honest drunk, join another outfit. I've had the privilege of calling on untold numbers of alcoholics who've called for help, or whose families have called for help, or who we've been sent over by friends. Not one's met me at the door and said, you got some steps I can start working. It's always, get me back in the big bed, call my boss, get me a shot at the hot, we're always up to something, and that's okay. Things begin to change. I'm going to sit down there in 2 minutes. We raise our kids in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were 5 and 6 years old when I joined there. Now he's turning 40. Yeah, the other day he said, my God, I'm going to be 40 next month. I said, it doesn't bother you near as much as it does your mother and me. Good place to raise children, especially if you're going to have teenagers. You're going to have teenagers, join something. Or shoot yourself. Why did I do all these things? I was motivated to do these things that were diametrically opposed to anything I naturally do. There's 12 things there that are diametrically opposed to anything that I would naturally do. Coming to meetings, doing service, doing things for others. Diametrically opposed to anything that was naturally part of my makeup. And I did them because I was motivated to do them, because I didn't want to die. I wanted to be like you. I didn't want to drink in the worst way, and somehow I knew I was going to drink if I didn't. But why do I really do them? We learn that after a while. No matter what motivates us to do it, the reason we do it, according to our book, is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and those about us. And the thing that I have that is as powerful as anything a person can have, you've got it too, is I've got my experience. I've got my strength. I've got my hope. I have my story. I have that thing about me that I can share with another drunk that the 9 in 10 the other people don't have. I sponsor right many people. I've just moved from Charlotte to Greensboro in the last few months, and the Charlotte Pigeons are still calling me. God love them. And I've had that privilege of sponsoring a lot of people, and what an exchange, what a relationship, something that does more for me than it does for them. More important than that, I am sponsored. I've got a sponsor that I'm accountable to. I've got a sponsor that I eat lunch with at least once a month. I've got a sponsor that we're connected. I got a sponsor who I told him, I said, I feel sorry for you, but you're the one that's got to hear every secret. Just before we moved back to Greensboro, the Greensboro area, we moved back, we closed on our house the 1st of August, and some on a hot July night on Saturday evening, Helen called me. Helen's 80 years old, and she's still on the answering service, 12-step list. She's that kind of gal. And she said, Bill, I have heard from this young man, and he's out in front of a, he's in a phone booth out in front of the Waffle House on South Boulevard. And of course, I can't come get him, and he wants somebody to come and get him. Will you call him? And she gave me the number of the phone booth. And I called, and he and another voice answered, and he said, I want to go to a meeting. And I said, well, I'm going. There's a 7 o'clock meeting, the Keystone Group there in Strawman. I'll come pick you up. And he said, I'll be sitting on this grassy little bank next to the phone booth in front of the Waffle House. And so Kay and I went and picked this young man up. And he climbed in the back of the car, and then we hear the rest of the stories. We go to the meeting, you know, how the drunk. He'd just been kicked out of the apartments right behind the Waffle House. He didn't have any place to go that night. You know how we are. And then I thought, oh, hell. Got a drunk on my hands. You know, what am I going to do with him? And I carried him to the meeting, and I said, this guy is probably just looking for birth and board like we do, and that's okay. I'll at least get him there. And I got him there, and one of the group members, Pryor, was there. And Pryor was one of these inmates at one of the halfway houses around town who'd worked himself. You know how we get in and we superstar and work himself up. We become custodian in the halfway house. He had worked himself up a little position of authority. And he said, I believe I can help him. Let me check it out. I believe I can get him at least a place for the night. Whew, had him off my hands. And so we left him in Pryor's hands, and I went on back. And just a few days afterwards, we moved to the Greensboro area. Totally forgot about this guy. I had the privilege to go back and talk at my home group's Christmas party. Buck was there. Ralph was there. Mike was there. Virginia. And it was a high privilege. And all the people coming up and talking to me and telling me they missed me and all those things that I wanted to hear, and telling Kay they'd missed her and all the things that we wanted to hear. There's a young guy tugging on my sleeve, and he said, I've been sober 6 months. And I didn't recognize him, but I told him how tickled I was that he'd been sober 6 months. And as other people come up to him, he wouldn't leave. And when he finally got my attention again, he said, I need to thank you for picking me up that night. He said, it wasn't just the fact that you came and picked me up and took me to a meeting. He said, but when I heard a voice on the phone, I knew somebody was there who cared and would come. And he told me a little bit of how good his life was now, and he was back at work, and he had a place to stay and all the good things. I believe that's why I'm here. I believe that's why you're here. Thank you very much.